Welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. The World Health Organization estimates that only 10% of our health is determined by health care, or what most of us think of as a trip to the doctor. If this is the case, what other factors determine our level of health? And if, collectively, we're spending $2.7 trillion per year on health care, how is there anything left to spend on such other determinants? Fortunately, in the United States, many of the determinants of health are already optimized for us culturally and economically. Safe drinking water, access to nutrition, and safety from political instability. It turns out that social factors contribute mightily to our overall health as well. Studies show that those with rich social networks tend, on average, to be healthier people both physically and emotionally. My guest today, Jan Feigert, has spent her life in pursuit of how to best improve social determinants of health for those most vulnerable in Greater Tulsa. Feigert is the Associate Director of the Community Service Council, a nonprofit umbrella agency in Tulsa that provides both research and action and service to match Tulsans in need with available resources. Jan Feigert, welcome to Studio Tulsa on Health.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
I want to start by asking you to define really or how we can improve social determinants of health here in Tulsa.
Well, I'll tell you what, that's an interesting way of going about it. Social determinants is really a term that's become very vogue in about the last 8 years. But it's basically saying the underlying conditions in which we all live and who we are and how we fulfill ourselves every day. But it's become recognized that you have to take that cultural position that we're all in and take it into consideration whenever you're providing health care or education or basically if you're promoting a product. Those things play into those decisions. So as an example, when we talk about gender or race, those are social determinants of health. When we talk about economics, education, where we live in the city, what our access is to health care, what our access is to the education process, all those things are social determinants. And we know that some of them are supportive of good health, good education, well-being, and we know that some are deterrents to those same. So we look at what the balance is, what's the likelihood that we can overcome negative social determinants, and what way we can enhance the more positive social determinants.
And you're very knowledgeable about this personally, but also in your work at the council,
yes.
Community Service Council of Tulsa. How does the council frame their mission in these terms?
Well, the Community Service Council is a little known agency in our eastern part of Oklahoma, but it's 71 years old. We're a research and planning council that helps support health and human service organizations. We try to inform the Tulsa Area United Way. We inform legislators. We inform city council, civic and social organizations, so that they can benchmark against improvements, particularly if programs or grants are received in order to do particular things. So from that standpoint of view, on an annual basis, we put together a profile that's called the Community Profile of Tulsa County. We do it for 29 different counties, have it on our website. We're a census information center, and then we look at the condition of our community. And that has been something we've done for 15 years in a very formal way, but certainly did it much more in an informal way in the past. Fascinating, you know, go back to what we are. We are an interesting state. We are not a very healthy state. And when we take a look at some of our determinants, such as heart disease, we're 48th worst in the United States in the number of people who die from heart disease. We are right now about 46th worst in the United States in economic conditions as far as the number of people in poverty. We're 50th worst in the United States in children who are recognized as not having adequate food. So when you're looking at food, education, employment, condition of our health, that becomes the ground clutter for anything that you try to do in other arenas like education or health.
We know about these statistics, and I mean, I've had several guests on this show that have talked about some of the dire outcomes and the formation, really, of the School of Community Medicine at University of Oklahoma in Tulsa is in part a response to that, as is many of the wonderful social agencies we have around town. So is it really a question of resources or a question of will, be it moral will or political will or sort of all of the above?
Well, you know what? I have always said it's a calculation of leadership. In order to address any issue, one has to have long-term committed leadership that is willing to navigate the difficult times, willing to hold up the successes, willing to deal with the challenges and the barriers, but continue to move things forward. I think that we have had a floundering of leadership in the last few years, and I would say it's probably a 20-year period of time, in which we really have not had someone that was willing to pick up that gauntlet and say, come hell or high water, we're going to make an improvement in this arena. Now, we've certainly had those kind of folks in the past. When you look at early childhood, we have been recognized as only one of two states that have K-4 program, voluntary K-4, available for any child that's 4 years old in Oklahoma. Now, it seemed like an overnight success, you know, because you have one little mention in the State of the Union speech by a president, and suddenly, you know, it just happened. That work began in 1985, and each incremental step built on the next step and scaffold until we have huge successes. Yet, when you take a look at who's been part of the leadership, it's been that tight-knit group, literally from the very beginning, that has helped move that forward, and adding new people as necessary. Periodically, folks have dropped off, but there's been a tight-knit group of leaders that have moved that forward. We don't always have that group that's highly focused, that leadership, and so we tend to flounder. So I don't lay it at the culture of our people so much. I don't necessarily lay it at public or political will, because with good leadership, all of those things can be overcome.
So when might we expect these early childhood programs to, quote-unquote, pay off in terms of breaking the cycle of poverty? It's a long-term investment, isn't it?
Well, you know what? When we particularly designed quality child care and began looking at the STAR system, when we as a state began looking at making available high-quality K-4 program in preparation before kindergarten began and the official public education began, there was a great deal of discussion regarding what the measurements would be and how would we know when we achieve success, because school readiness was kind of the mantra. But when you look at researched programs such as Absiderian Project or the Perry Preschool Project, or if you take a look at the Chicago Parent-Child, even in the longitudinal studies, they didn't say kids would do better with third grade reading scores. They didn't say that what you would have is A's on your math exam. What they said was is that if you have systematic, high quality, stimulating structure, that children were more likely to be successful in school, graduate from high school, more likely not to become teen parents, engage in drug and alcohol use, become incarcerated, and more likely to become productive citizens. And now that we're looking at longitudinal studies from that, we're actually seeing longitudinal studies from those original projects. We're seeing that that indeed was the promise that was made. Our expansion into really high quality child care and the K-4 program was about 1998. I recently was asked to give a quote to a media outlet regarding why had teen birth rates been held steady or declining over the last particular 5 years. And I got out, as any researcher would do, and began laying out the data, and I looked at what we would consider the normal suspects. Well, the use of contraception must have gone up. It had not. The use of condoms must have gone up. It had not. I looked at abortions. Had abortions gone up? They had not. So during that same period of time, and even for 10 years preceding that, those things had not been huge variables. What was the difference that we could definitively see is that there were more children staying in school and completing high school than we had had. There was more children that were going, the going rate to college had increased during that period of time. We also saw that there had been basically a movement forward on improvement in what we would consider the math and science scores, okay? There were gains made. So when I reported back to the folks, I said, you know, it is not teen pregnancy prevention programs. It's not contraception. What the difference is that they have been involved in structured, high-quality care, and those kids that entered in 1998 are now becoming, you know, are our graduates. Are our middle school students. And so we're finally seeing that payoff. Wow. Now, if that continues to grow, we can then hopefully say that our investment has increased the number of potential professionals that we have in our community, and professionals are more likely to have the opportunity to better paying jobs, which then increases the potential for the entire community to succeed.
Consumer spending,
exactly.
And on the cascade.
Exactly.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa on Health. I'm John Schumann sitting in for Rich Fisher. My guest today, Jan Feigert, Associate Director of the Community Service Council. Tell me a little bit about the history of the council. I mean, 1941 seemed like a dark time. We were maybe about to enter World War II, I guess. How did this council come about?
Very fascinating question. It was Community Chest, the Red Feather Community Chest, which is the predecessor to the United Way. They would have a planning arm, and in this case, the planning arm was a council of community services. Okay, and so it fed and provided information. It incorporated itself in 1941 as an independent structure and then began this very first study. You spoke about the war. The very first study was the impact on childcare by women going to support the war effort. But since then, if you take a look, ours is a, we identify issues in the community. We put those benchmarks and those indicators around it. We draw people together in coalitions and initiatives, the unnatural act of collaboration, okay, putting down your Kevlar and being willing to engage. And what we have found is that we have addressed issues such as domestic violence. At our table, the planning for domestic violence intervention services was created. At our table, when we were trying to address the issues of teen pregnancy in our community in the 60s, Margaret Hudson program was created. When we take a look at addressing the issues of behavioral health in our community, the Mental Health Association of Tulsa was created. So we helped to be the catalyst of addressing needs in our community by bringing leaders together, people together that's able to embrace and then take that mission forward.
Well, I mean, I love that story of collaboration. So in a sense, are you the nerve plexus for a variety of these different community agencies that focus on these specific areas, or a clearinghouse of information and research? And then I suppose the bigger question, funding. Collaboration is wonderful until dollars start to flow and each organization needs dollars to support its mission. So how does that work out?
Absolutely. I'll answer each one of those questions independently. First of all, there are currently 29 different initiatives that the Community Service Council embraces, everything from early childhood to veterans initiative to therapeutic courts such as the veterans court, drug court, mental health court, prison reentry, again, healthcare transformation in this particular time. So over 29 different initiatives do our planners work with and, again, cultivate that soil. Yes, we are data clearinghouse. We are a census information center, the only one in Oklahoma. The state data center was recently defunded by state legislature, and so the census work will now focus significantly out of the Oklahoma Public Library System and the Community Service Council. And so we do. I laughingly say we take requests and we do a data analysis for high school students all the way through legislators, and sometimes the high school students, I'll get an email at midnight, and they're needing data by the next morning at 9.
Procrastinators.
Procrastinators like we all are. And yes, we are a clearinghouse for research. Now, you asked the question regarding funding. As far as our funding goes, we're a nice combination of community support, such as through the Tulsa Area United Way, the George Kaiser Family Foundation, et cetera. We also have state funding. Example of that would be through the Department of Human Services. We also have support through Department of Education. And then at the federal level, we have funding through the Office of the National Coordinator for HIT. We have a grant through the Department, several grants through the Department of Justice. So we have a wide federal grants, we have et cetera. Now, oftentimes, particularly for small community agencies, they do not have the resources of a grant writer. So as far as those initiatives go, if they need a grant writer to help produce a grant that on behalf of the community we bring in and then distribute, our annual budget runs about $6.5 million. But what we distribute back out to the community is four times that amount, meaning we may bring money in or facilitate money to have come into the community through grants and contracts that then go to other agencies.
That's astounding. I mean, are there other examples with that type of return on investment? Or, I mean, I don't know how you would characterize it because it's not necessarily an investment, but where your annual operating cost budget mm-hmm. is quadrupled like that in terms of the impact you have or the outreach to other organizations? I mean, that's just tremendous.
Well, particularly, yes, there are other agencies like us. In the United States, there's 37 of them. And then there's two that are international that work as part of an entire collaborative. It's called the National Association of Planning Councils. As far as in Oklahoma, there's a couple of entities that are similar to us, not exactly like us. I think we know where our niche is, they know where their niche is, and we collaborate, and we do fine. A CAP agency, a Community Action Project, basically is a federal designation that says that you will collaborate and you will bring together people on certain issues. And there's a planning council in Oklahoma City, much smaller than ours, that is affiliated with United Way in Oklahoma City. So we are not alone by any means. But we have had, I spoke of leadership, we have had strong leadership for many, many years that have said that we will be, can you imagine a board saying to an organization, our mission is research and planning and coalition building. Now you build those coalitions, you help fund those events, those activities, those organizations that need to be developed. And we will keep a one arm's length from that work so that those organizations are self-determining. So they don't live under the mission of the council. The mission of the council is to create those and to then let them fly and let them to become. And so on the part of leadership, that takes a lot of internal strength to say, well, you know what? We may not agree. We may not have the same mission. We may not have the same voice. But what we do agree is that this is what the community wants. So therefore, let it become. And so the Community Service Council has launched many projects along that line. They get it to a certain point. We laughingly call when it gets to be an adolescent, it's time to get rid of it. But basically, we help that organization through that germative phase. Many of them are very successful. Some of them survive, and then like a light, they dim. My Health, which is the Health Information Exchange, birthed at the table in 2009, the mayor, Kathy Taylor, had brought together people of like interest. They needed somebody to be the home for it to get started. The Community Service Council is now in its 33rd month of being that home, and by September 30th, we plan on its full launch. Same thing was true with DIVIS, with Mental Health Association, with Margaret Hudson Program. They needed a little startup time. They get their work done. Their board launches them, and they're on their way.
I mean, a lot of business jargon words come to mind, like incubator or social venture funds almost, or social venture enterprises almost giving birth to these.
Those are excellent terms that would put into frame of reference basically the genre. When you think about health and human services, for the most part, these are venues in which there's no money to be made. We laugh about federal or state funding or contractual funding. There's no other business that you go into except a nonprofit where when the times get bad, the funding sources dry up and the demand for the services you provide get greater. And then the presumption is you'll be able to provide more with less. And we do things that financially, if you attempted to do them, a business would go out of business trying to do it. So you have to think about health and human services as really we're frequently encouraged to adapt a business model, but a business model will not hold up in a nonprofit health and human service organization because there is truly no profit to be made. And so it's that challenge. That mission becomes more important than those business structures that talking about venture capitalism or entrepreneurism sometimes generates in your mind.
You mentioned health care reform, and specifically My Health. We had Dr. Kendrick on the program who discussed what he's doing there in terms of health information exchange. So Community Service Council was integral then in bringing together the various components or players and helping with the grant?
We have helped with the grant. We have hosted it as the grant manager and the financial manager. It is becoming very successful, and as I say, we anticipate full launch probably around September or October, and then at that point, we gently continue to support it as it needs help. Think about this, particularly since we have had many challenges in related to economics, and there have been funds available to help expand employment and to be able to meet the needs of the community during this dire time, okay? And in Oklahoma, we can anticipate this protracted nature of this economic recession to be well into 2020, okay? So our recovery is going to be slow and diligent and filled with ups and downs, but we're on the road. All the time during that time, many agencies lost their funding capacity, okay? They lost federal contracts. They lost state contracts. Sequestration is biting again because many of their contracts have been lost. The first place that a nonprofit cuts back is in that administrative overhead, you know, the ability to have financial support, the full human resource support you need, all of those rules that you have to comply with having federal or state money. We took a number of programs that we considered key to our community under our wing during this period of time to recognize that these organizations, these projects could not die because of lack of funding. And so we have nurtured those to then let them fly again. Now, My Health was coming on right at that moment of changes going on in the economic environment. They could have stood up a complete business department. They could have stood up a complete HR, the administration, what it takes to make those grants successful. And in doing so, it would have hamstring them. So for a period of time, we have provided in a collaborative effort, and we have helped hold those pieces together, and so that it had a good start and has taken off. We see our role as that, is whenever sometimes it's external crises, sometimes it's internal crises, but we see that there's certain threads as part of the safety net that are so essential in our community that they must be maintained.
I want to shift gears and ask you about a specific program that I believe you mentioned is actually operated by the council, which is the 211 program,
yes.
Or it's housed there.
Yes. This is a program we had a helpline for a number of years at the Community Service Council. And with a collaborative framework with Mental Health Association, a number of other folks had contracts so that we had the providers that we could make these referrals to, and we had a 24-hour service. The momentum really broke in an entirely new direction when United Way of America began looking at the potential of having a 211 service again. Think about 911. You call them for emergencies. We were finding out that a lot of people were calling 911 for health and social service reasons. So we began working with like-minded people in the community, bringing again them to the table, and now we have 211. 211 as a call center in Tulsa that we sponsor, and then there's a call center in Oklahoma City. And so we each have part of the state. We're receiving 15,000 calls per month. It hit that fevered pitch right after the ice storm of about 2009 and has never slowed down since that time. The top three reason people call is assistance with utilities. They're homeless or near homeless, so their basic needs are not being met, the need for food, and then health care. So 15,000 callers per month that have one or more needs that need to be assisted with, back to that social determinants of health, before they can get to their job, before they can get their kids to school that day, before they can just make it through the day sometimes.
And one would assume that those healthcare needs would wind up in the emergency room where they're ill-suited if they're much more in the social determinant realm. I mean, housing, there's not much an ER can do except provide shelter, obviously, in a crisis. So, you know, we do see that a fair bit.
On the healthcare, the range goes that they are new to the community. They have not established themselves with a doctor. Where might they go? Two, I have a broken arm, but I have no money. Where is a free clinic? We also crisis calls. They are suicidal, and we handle that until we can make a warm handoff to a crisis line or until the police can come and assist, or one of our behavioral health sites can assist with a crisis intervention. So we run the gamut when it comes to healthcare.
How big an operation is that? I mean, how many staff does it take to field 15,000 phone calls a month? And moreover, what's the training level of those individuals to be able to handle such sensitive information?
All of our folks are bachelor's level counselors or better. And we have, I'm going to get shot by the 211 staff. I believe that there are 18 full-time and part-time employees. The majority of the calls, as you can imagine, comes in from about 10 o'clock till about 6 o'clock every day. And then we have remote call capabilities to then handle calls in the evening. We really became famous when, again, we laugh about the ice storm of 2009, because we were identified as the mayor's 211. And we had a good laugh about that from the standpoint of view that people began calling us wanting to know when their electricity could be connected back, was their house safe to be able to turn on the washing machine, I mean, all kinds of things. And so that, again, we hit our first peaks at 15,000, and then people began knowing who we were from that point on.
So really, it is well known. I mean, I was under the impression that people maybe weren't so aware of it. I took a group of interns. I didn't actually go to 211, but one of our car groups did go visit there, and it was completely new to these, you know, training medical doctors. So it's an incredibly valuable resource that you're part of. I wanted to ask your personal story here at the end. How did you get involved with the council?
I don't think anyone gets up of a morning and says, I'm going to be Don Quixote and I'm going to, you know, tilt windmills. I'm a registered nurse by background. It was a really sad situation that the very first delivery that I participated in as a student, the baby died. I said, I'm not going to do that again. I am going to work the rest of my life to make sure that no babies die. And I focused for that period of time on the one, working with the one. And then I realized that there were thousands of ones, and they were lining up, you know, with it to serve. So then I began working in education, nursing education, and I was a teacher for a number of years. And I saw myself serving the 100 because I could teach 100 students, and then they would go out with the same passion that I did and could serve more. And I had the opportunity to work with the Area Health Education Center that was sponsored out of Oklahoma State University. I worked with doctors and nurses in interdisciplinary training. And then I began realizing that in order to really make differences, you have to affect the 1,000. And so my education and career has scaffolded, again, using the term, one step to the next step to the next step till I realized that you really make a difference when you're managing policy. And so at the Community Service Council, one of the areas that I do is policy analysis and policy development.
So at this point, do you consider yourself more of a researcher or an advocate, or is there any point in delineating between the two?
I'm a planner. I am a consummate planner, which means that you have to use those two tools plus many, many more. You have to know the game, you have to know the players, and you have to know the rules. And the game, the players, and the rules are always changing. And so you have to know where the game is moved to and how to play within the rules of the moment. I have found myself in this part of my career spending a lot of time bridging our community to the federal government and to federal leadership because we have been somewhat stymied by state leadership, particularly in healthcare transformation, particularly in where we will be going in the future with healthcare. At times, though, in work that I've done, it has been a strong bridge between the community and the state, and the federal was not much of a player. So, again, it's the moment. And what you see now going on at the council is a great deal of effort of making sure that healthcare transformation occurs, that we begin looking at quality of care, particularly in order to create patient safety and to reduce unnecessary care that sometimes is both costly to that individual personally as well as economically, trying to make sure that there is that thread of continuance from where the patient is at to where the patient wants to be and all the care that has to be wrapped around to reach that moment. So it's education, it's advocacy, it's throwing sand in the sandbox, it's it's planning, it's putting data out there and showing measurement and improvement as a result of even the most minuscule thing that we do. And so this is just an incredibly exciting time when it comes to where we can be a few years from now in healthcare.
Well, I've learned a tremendous amount today. I want to thank you very much for coming down and sharing with us about the Community Service Council. You are a very good spokesman for your work.
Well, you're very kind. Thank you very much, and I've appreciated being here today.
Thanks so much. Jan Feigert is Associate Director of the Community Service Council of Tulsa. Well, that's our show for today. Our show is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views expressed on Studio Tulsa are those of our guests and commentators and do not necessarily reflect opinions of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. If you've missed any of our recent shows, you can find them online at publicradiotulsa.org. Just look for the Studio Tulsa link under the Programs tab. I'm John Schumann, sitting in for Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.